I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guests are Mark Laurie and Vinny Barrara, co-founders of Diapers.com, the online retail site specializing in baby products. Mark and Vinny started Diapers.com in 2005, and Amazon bought the parent company, Quitsy, for $540 million in 2010. Quitsy also owns other e-commerce sites, including Soap.com, focused on cleaning supplies, Wag.com, focused on pet products, and Yoyo.com, specializing in toys. Quitsy is based in Jersey City, New Jersey. Welcome.
Thank you.
You both grew up in New Jersey, and you met each other for the first time as friends in elementary school. What appealed to you about each other?
We met in when we were 10 years old in fifth grade, and I think early on we were both big Yankee fans and both into sports, like playing sports, any sport basically. And so I think that was one of the first things that definitely connected us.
I think when Mark first came, by the way, he came in, I was at that school beforehand. And I remember, you know, coming in from Staten Island. So this school was in Tin Falls by the Jersey Shore. And Mark was always a little bit different, or started out different. He was this brash kid, you know, definitely an athlete. He had a lot of spunk, and I was more shy and introverted. So I don't know, in those early years, we were friends, but I think we became much closer.
Yeah, as the years went on.
Yeah,
right?
In high school. And then after that, you know, we did a lot of stuff together. We studied abroad. We lived together in New York for a year. We were each other's, you know, best men at each other's weddings. So very close.
At what point did you first start talking about building a business together?
I think it was probably in 1999. I was a banker at the time, making, you know, very good money. I was on a great career path. He was a lawyer, same thing, situation there. And we just asked ourselves, do we want to be doing this for the next 30, 40 years?
Yeah, you did have a diverse professional life before starting your first company together. Mark, as you mentioned, you were an investment banker. And you, Vinny, you were a lawyer. And you helped to draft the distribution plan for the $1.25 billion settlement, which was a class action lawsuit initiated by the victims of the Holocaust against the Swiss banks. Can you talk briefly about that case and that experience?
Yeah, that was great. I had started, as you mentioned, as a litigator at a large firm and then went to a smaller firm, and I was given the opportunity to work on a team of four or five lawyers recommending a plan to the judge to figure out how to distribute this pool of money, which might seem like a lot, $1.25 billion, but actually was quite small in the scheme of things given the number of victims. And so, you know, we were trying to do that in a way which fit the law, but at the same time also trying to figure out a way that we would do this in a manner that was fair and equitable and would have meaning to the victims, because given the fact there were so many, the last thing we wanted to do was give, you know, $5 or something small to each person. Our recommendation was to give the majority of the proceeds to the folks in Eastern Europe who we thought had suffered quite a bit and hadn't gotten, through some of the other cases, most of the proceeds. So it was a great experience.
Were you feeling the same professionally as Mark was when you decided, you know what, let's start a company together? Like, what was your state of mind at the time?
Yeah, it was, you know, as Mark mentioned, it was the late 90s. It was the internet heyday. We actually had another friend that was one of our co-founders, and I was single at the time and thought, you know, this was just a great opportunity to take a risk, be able to work with your best friends, and take a shot at a business we thought, you know, made sense. And so I don't know how much thinking, quite frankly. I think I was 28 years old or something. We were a little bit spontaneous.
We didn't take a salary or anything. It was pretty, I'd say, pretty rash.
Yeah,
decision, right?
Yeah.
So this company that you first started was ThePit.com, and it was an online collectibles stock market for, let's say, trading sports cards. And you mentioned before your interest in baseball. You're both avid Yankee fans. The company was sold to Topps, where you both were working. I guess there was an agreement when the company was bought you had to work there. At what point did the idea for Diapers.com originate?
I think the idea probably started around 2003. Mm-hmm. I think. So it was a couple of years before we actually launched it. We started talking about it, thinking about it.
One thing was funny is I remember I had just gotten married, as Mark said, in 2003, and I went on my honeymoon, and I think the day I got back, Mark had called me and said, I got something. I got an idea. I want to go buy this domain name 1-800-DIAPERS. Actually, I want to go buy the phone number, I think, 1-800-DIAPERS. I don't remember, it was 5 grand or something.
Yeah, 5 grand.
And you would, you know, and you would actually at my, I think, wedding night.
On the bus.
On
the
wedding
bus.
On the party bus.
I was throwing it out there.
You were throwing it out there to all of my friends. We thought you were crazy. So I was ruminating, you know, during my wedding honeymoon. So when we came back, as I recall, at the end of, you know, in 03 is when we actually did it. We bought the domain name in October of 2003.
1-800-diapers.com.
That's right.
We couldn't afford diapers.com at the time.
Yeah.
How much was it at the time?
I mean, it was hundreds of thousands, maybe even a million. We didn't actually look even into it. It was so expensive at that time.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guests are Mark Lorry and Vineet Barrara, co-founders of the e-commerce company Diapers.com. The company sells more than 40,000 baby products and was sold to Amazon in 2010. Diapers.com, it's an online retail site for all the types of baby supplies, but it is logistically very intensive. It's very exacting supply inventory system and shipping operations and customer service. And you need, you know, real efficiencies in order to be able to make money from essentially commodities. Can you describe what your warehouse looks like?
Sure. We have three different warehouses. Each of them fully equipped with robots. The robots actually do and fetch all the product and bring it back to a picking station where somebody who's standing stationary picks from the shelves that were brought to them from these robots. You know, on the right side and left side of this picker, there might be four or five empty brown boxes that were brought there by robots. And so based on what people order and knowing the sizes of the order, we have an algorithm that will go through and sort of fit it into the smallest box possible, like a little Rubik's Cube. And so the person will just see it says, make box 3. And then when the box is full, a light flashes and says, now you've picked everything for this box. You hit the button and the robot will then take the box to a place where it gets taped and dunnage. You know, the plastic stuff goes in there to protect it. And then it'll get automatically on conveyor put into whatever UPS, FedEx, or other truck that's waiting at one of the bays. So as you said, we built all our own proprietary technology, all our own inventory systems, all our own supply chain systems, this boxing software, all the things that we needed to do to squeeze every penny out of the supply chain. Because as you said, the commodity goods.
How many robots are in each warehouse, roughly?
I don't know the exact number, but there are hundreds of robots.
And what do they look like?
They're basically about maybe a foot high off the ground, and maybe 4 feet long by 3 feet wide, and capable of carrying thousands of pounds. There's like highways, digital highways, throughout the entire warehouse that these robots are reading in order to know how to get to where they need to go.
How did you know how to build all this specialized software? Because you certainly didn't come from the logistics business prior.
Well, we were fortunate that in our previous business, the Pit, we had a chief technology officer named Wei Yan, and we enlisted him early on to do all of our development and software programming, gave him some equity, because in the beginning we actually worked nights and weekends and hadn't quit our jobs. So he was a mainstay in terms of doing all the technology.
Now, you know, we talk about how efficient and high-tech this whole system is, but it didn't always look this squeaky clean. You started off in a very ad hoc manner. Can you talk about the early days when you just had launched 1-800-diapers.com? What did it look like?
Well, in the very early days, we actually didn't even have boxes. We actually had someone, a stay-at-home mom, that we hired to do the fulfillment and the customer service. So she would use Vonage. I don't know if you know that phone system. That would be our customer service.
This is Gina DePaola?
Yes, Gina.
Okay.
Gina. So she would use Vonage to answer the calls, and she was the only rep. And so there would be times, you know, it took off a little bit in the beginning, and customers would call, and the customer would say, hey, can I speak to your supervisor? And, of course, there was no supervisor. She would say, hang on a second. And then she'd take a second, and she'd come back and disguise her voice. And you know, to do a high-pitched voice, and she'd be the supervisor. So it was, and again, and
that's
also
a true story.
Yeah, and she would do this out of her garage, and
she was a college friend of yours, Mark.
College friend of my wife's.
Of your wife's,
So she was doing this out of her garage in Long Island, and the other thing was that basically she was storing these cases of diapers on her lawn. And so there was a whole issue anytime it'd rain or anything like that, what do you do? And the tarp and her dad, it was crazy, right? So those early days, we didn't have the logistics. As I said, we didn't even have box. We'd strap the diapers and the wipes together with rope, basically.
Yeah, things were moving so fast in the early stages that seriously, we didn't even think about things like rain. I mean, it was just put it out on the lawn, you know, until we got the call.
Did you just partner with, let's say, you know, these large diaper suppliers and baby products companies?
Venturi? No, this is really funny. No, we Procter & Gamble and Kimberly-Clark, which are the two biggest diaper manufacturers, they weren't able to sell us directly, or they didn't want to sell us directly for the first 2 years of the business. So we had to buy the product from BJ's Wholesale Club. You had to physically go into the store and put it on your credit card and pay for it. And in the beginning, it was fine. But it got to the point where one BJ's wasn't enough to satisfy our demand. We'd have to go to like 4, 5, 6, 7 BJ's and clean them out completely. But it was a long time before we were actually able to buy direct.
Yeah, our parents, we would use the parents' credit cards. So my dad, you know, Indian-American, is a sort of, it's actually just Indian, I should say, huge accent, would be going into these BJ's and would be ordering something like $80,000 worth of product. And these, but it was done in this odd thing where it was sort of done, yeah, not in the back room, it was almost like he was standing at the counter. And this receipt would come out, it'd be like 10 feet long, you know, $80,000 of it. He'd call me like, I don't know, son, I got 200 BJ size 3 Pampers, and we'd be like double checking this whole thing, and it was crazy. And your dad too would be going.
Oh yeah, my dad would go in.
We were just using any credit card we could, basically.
So you essentially were cash flow positive. You were getting a lot of cash from customers.
Oh yeah,
even
it was perfect. We had no working capital. It was negative working capital. Yeah, basically had we're getting paid in 2 days and didn't have to pay for it for 30 days. That's what kept us going. That's how we financed the business in large part, but. Unfortunately, it meant losing like $5, $6 every box we sold. So those losses started to add up too.
So here you are, you're hemorrhaging money, and you know that because these are basically commodities, it's very hard to make a profit selling online. So what was your ultimate belief about the company?
Yeah. That's a great question. I think the strategy early on we recognized was all about first, a mission to make mom's life easier. So that meant, you know, overnight or two-day shipping. You know, 77% of the country now is getting overnight, even some of it same day. So super fast delivery with a really top-notch customer service experience. So 365-day return policy, no questions at all. We have all customer service staff in our corporate office with us. We felt like if we can ship the stuff fast, at good prices, with great customer service and a really wide assortment, that this is something that could make mom's life easier, and they'd sort of come back to the site over and over again, and we'd from then be able to sell them hopefully everything else that they might need.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guests are Mark Lorre and Vinny Barrara, co-founders of Diapers.com. We'll hear more from Mark and Vinny coming up. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guests are Mark Lorre and Vinny Barrara, co-founders of Diapers.com, the online retail site specializing in baby products. Mark and Vinny started Diapers.com in 2005, and Amazon bought the parent company Quitsy for $540 million in 2010. Quitsy also owns other e-commerce sites, including Soap.com, focused on cleaning supplies, Wag.com, focused on pet products, and Yoyo.com, specializing in toys. Quitsy is based in Jersey City, New Jersey. So this was the ultimate vision, but while you were in the weeds, losing money, hardly had boxes, did not have the high-tech systems in place, was there a turning point at some point where you're like, wow, you know what, this is actually starting to work?
Yeah. Well, really early on in the first, 4 months, five months after we launched, it was a small... I remember I was traveling with my wife, and we were visiting her alma mater, Georgetown, and it was a Saturday morning, and you know, we weren't doing that many orders, and we had a back-end system where you could check, you know, how many orders were being fulfilled by Gina. And I remember going to the library, Georgetown Library, and going to log it into the system, and I saw, whoa, there were something like 200 orders that morning, or 250 orders, which for us at the time was a lot. Parenting magazine had found out about us and had just in a one-sentence blurb mentioned us. And with that very small mention on some page 37 of the magazine, a lot of people responded. And so I think we saw there that there was some kind of connection we were establishing with customers, even as we didn't have all the logistics set. I think we knew that we had something. Mm-hmm. It did then take another 12 months before we quit our jobs in the summer of 2006 before we got our act together and figured out how we were going to go raise money and write a business plan. But I think within those first few months, we saw that the customers were telling us that they liked what we were doing. Even though we didn't have it, there was a need. And nobody was doing it, right? Because to your point earlier, you know, it's very difficult to do it in any kind of way that generates any type of return.
What was your family life like at the time? You had just recently gotten married, but any kids in the picture?
I had my first kid in 2000 and the second kid in 2003. So in 2005, I had two little kids, basically.
And I got married in 2003 when the idea was born, but in 2005, my first child was born. So within a few months of launch, my first child was born, so we were able to use the service.
Oh, I heard somewhere one of you used cloth diapers and had trouble finding cloth diapers. Is that a myth?
Oh, I think that's a myth.
That's a myth.
Yeah. We didn't use cloth diapers.
So you are the role model for, you know, successfully scaling a specialized commodity business. But other companies before you have failed. There's, you know, Pet.com, which is like the poster child of failure and from the internet era. Why do you think, what did you do well that other companies before you did not do well, do you think?
I think first we had a very long-term strategy. And that long-term strategy was predicated on building relationship with the commodity consumables, recognizing that we weren't going to make money on those consumables, that we would make money on the build off the relationship and selling the higher margin goods. So it was a long-term strategy that required a lot of capital. So it's you know, I think a lot of these businesses probably would have worked. The idea was a little bit before their time, and they probably were undercapitalized. And second is that we did not hire our first employee until March of 2007. So for 2 years after launch, we continued to invest aggressively in building the technology, the infrastructure, and the back-end systems. So it wasn't like most businesses, marketing, revenue-led. We really knew that there wasn't going to be time later to figure that out, that we had to be absolutely the most efficient, you know, from day one.
So you really focused on the back end first, and you knew that, like, the small margin products were kind of the Trojan horse for the business.
Exactly.
You're still not making money from selling diapers,
right,
but you're making money from selling clothes.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
I think this is a good point, which is those first 2 years we were building the infrastructure, but we didn't hire our first employees, Mark said, and we didn't go out and raise capital outside of friends and family until also basically fall of 2006. So when we went out to go raise capital, we had 18 months of history. We had a model. We could do reasonable projections. And then I think maybe what was most important for the next several years thereafter was we hit our numbers every month. And
that was
with,
big.
With hitting our numbers every month, we built a lot of trust with our investors. We could then ask for more money to invest more in marketing or to make other investments in CapEx or to open up the warehouses.
At the end of the day, if you really want to pick one thing, it was just that. Because without the capital, we wouldn't be here today, especially in a business that had sort of started with negative gross margins. To get capital is very challenging in that environment. So the only way we were able to do that was we kept doing exactly what we said.
Yeah.
Here's the long-term plan. This is step one, and we hit it. This is step two, and we hit it.
Incidentally, this is aside, but I'm sitting here in front of you guys, and just you seem like two characters from like The Office or something.
That doesn't sound very. Which characters now?
I'll take that.
You just seem very like two very unlikely guys to be starting a highly intensive logistical company.
You can take that
as a compliment, Mark.
I'll take that.
But are you surprised ultimately that this is the type of company and the type of field that you have really honed in on? I mean, because now you have a number of e-commerce companies, from diapers.com to Yo-Yo and et cetera.
Right. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I'm not necessarily surprised. I mean, I think a lot of our business is certainly the logistics and the technology, but at its core, it is about this customer, this mom that Mark was describing earlier that we focused on. There's all these little things, whether it's in our customer service department or in the way we organize our website or how we name our companies or in the advertising campaigns that we try to do that have some humor, and just making sure the experience is simple. So there's a lot of emotion that we try to bring to our brands in addition to the logistics, and I think we hired really well.
You mentioned humor. The tagline for diapers.com is "We deliver everything but the baby."
That's right. That's right.
Who came up with that?
I don't know. Do we?
Did you hire me?
Oh, yeah, Mark came up with it. Mark got it.
There's so many things we've come up with. Did you forget we've come up with what?
Well, we have another one, too, which is, because we don't have it on the website, but it's on our T-shirts, which is we're number one and number two. So I think that one. Sometimes I'll wear that T-shirt on the streets and people like that one.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guests are Mark Lorre and Vineet Barrara, co-founders of the e-commerce company Quitsy. Quitsy is the parent company for sites including Diapers.com, a baby products retailer, Wag.com, which focuses on pet products, Soap.com, specializing in cleaning supplies, and Yo-Yo.com, an online toy retailer.
And you said that comment before about us being two characters from The Office. I think we're just real, you know, and I think the company itself is like that. And those are the kind of people that we look to hire.
We spend a lot of time when we interview folks, more so probably than anyone else, figuring out whether or not we're going to get along with them, whether they're going to treat people really well.
And there's one question we ask, and it's the only question that we ask, that if you don't answer it correctly, you don't get the job. And
are you going to give it away? Go ahead.
I got to give it to him.
Give it to him.
Would you rather be perceived in the workforce if you had a choice? Only pick one of these. Perceived in the workforce as being a super smart asshole or a super nice idiot.
Oh, come on, guys.
Is it easy? It's easy?
Of course.
Wow. So maybe, well, what's the answer?
B.
Did she answer it right?
Yeah, she got it right.
Come on.
Lots of people don't answer it that way.
Yeah. You'd be surprised.
Just remember, you are then being perceived as an idiot. Like, it's not like, you know, sort of, you know, completely, you know, dumb.
Super nice idiot. Some people answer incorrectly, but there are a lot of people that struggle, really struggle with it. They just struggle with it, and that kind of tells you something, too. So
back to 2007, you changed your name from 1-800-DIAPERS to finally diapers.com. What is the story behind that? How did you ultimately buy the URL?
Yeah, it wasn't easy. The guy that had it obviously didn't want to sell it for a long time. We made some big offers, really wasn't responding. So at the end of the day, we looked to our advisor and board member, Lynn Lodish, who's professor at Wharton Business School, and he wrote a letter on Wharton letterhead from him presenting the offer and sent it FedEx. And it wasn't until that happened that the guy actually responded to the offer and we were able to negotiate a price.
What? How much was it? Are we talking hundreds of thousands of dollars?
Yeah, hundreds of thousands of dollars,
I want to talk about raising capital. You had, you know, a few hundred thousand dollars of seed capital initially. Is that from, you know, your father who was buying diapers?
Yeah,
on his credit card? Or
we self-funded a lot of it, and then we got some funding from friends and family. But we did self-fund a lot of it as well.
What was the experience like with venture capitalists? Ultimately, you raised about $70 million from firms including NEA, New Enterprise Associates, and Bessemer. Are there any interesting anecdotes there?
Let's just say it got easier each round. The first round was very, very challenging. Like, this was at the end of 2006. We weren't able to get any of the really big VCs, so Bessemer, Excel, and NEA came in the B, C, and D rounds. The A round was really challenging, so we wind up looking to a lot of the angel investors that supported us at thepit.com, and we sort of pieced that $4 million together.
One of the things I do remember was it was definitely easier later, except for 2008. After the meltdown.
Oh, yeah, after the meltdown in 08,
So we had a term sheet, we're ready to go, we were doing the diligence, and every day, you know, the market was down 100 points, down 200 points. And at some point, you know, we just didn't know whether the deal was going to close. And to Excel's credit, actually, and Samir Gandhi, who's on our board, you know, he honored the commitment because who knew what was going to happen at that point just in terms of the economy. But until you actually, the money's in the bank, you don't know whether that deal is going to close. And so he was West Coast time, and they were just sort of dilly-dallying at the end with sort of some signatures and stuff. And I think the wiring deadline was 3 o'clock, right? 3 o'clock Pacific time. And, you know, and it was 2:55, and we thought, you know, money's going to come in, money's going to come in, money's coming in, and we were calling him. And at some point, it's like, you know, why don't we just wire the money tomorrow? I remember
saying, yeah.
We're like, no, you got to wire it today. No, you got to wire it today. It's nerve-wracking, you know, because you'd hear stories about people, you know, pulling the plug, even when you thought the deal was done.
I want to switch gears. I want to talk about Amazon. You have been obsessed with Jeff Bezos and Amazon. They've been, you know, both a role model and a fierce competitor up until they bought you in 2010. And one example of your kind of hyper-focus on them is one of you has read every 10K since 1996.
Well, I think they were, a decade ahead of us in terms of when they started that business. So there were a lot of learnings for us. Reading those 10Ks was incredibly valuable as we read 10Ks of other retailers in the space, Toys R Us and Walmart and stuff, really just trying to understand the retail space. Neither one of us had any retail experience at all.
I remember one letter to shareholders. He writes these great letters to shareholders every year, and I think personally pens them. And one of them that we refer to often is, you know, they're a very analytical company as we are, very data-driven, do a lot of things based on the math of what makes sense. But there are certain decisions, and in his example that he gives in his letter, he's talking about prices. And in every price test that they did, a short-term price test, you know, it never paid to cut prices. But then at times, you know, you just have to use judgment. And those are the hard decisions, the ones where you can't solve with math. And I think we also, you know, sort of that was something that I at least, and Mark and I have sort of taken to heart too, which is we're an incredibly analytical company, but there's all of these decisions along the way that are very judgment-oriented, that you're not going to be able to use math. You just kind of have to use your instincts.
What's one really good example?
I think the colored boxes that we send out, for example, soap.com. If you ever to order from Soap, it's basically the outer corrugate box that goes to UPS is blue, green, red, and I think orange on each of the four sides, full color box. It costs probably an extra 30 cents to put that in color versus just a brown corrugate. But we believe in the power of marketing and those boxes sitting in the lobbies of New York City apartments and things.
I mean, the way we approach customer service itself, which is, you know, we invest a lot in it. It's expensive.
Handwritten notes, too. We send out about 200 handwritten notes per day out to customers. You know, any customer that has, you know, a bad experience or a complaint or things, and the customer service representatives will take the time to do that.
You know, ultimately, you were very focused on Amazon throughout the whole period leading up to their purchase. And at one point, they started paying attention to you. How did you know that they started paying attention to you?
Just to look at their prices.
Yeah, I think that's what happened, yeah.
I think, you know, you could just tell by looking at the prices. But then they launched Amazon Mom, I think, in 2010. 2009, I forget the years now. 2009,
it's 30% off diapers.
Yeah, and I think you know, we could tell at that point that yeah, there was a, you know, big player in the space. There was always a big player in the space, but it was going to be, you know, a little bit more challenging with those kinds of prices.
And when that started happening, were you like, let's put on the boxing gloves, or what was your emotional reaction to that?
Well, I think that the good thing, and even today, is that our customers, you know, we're not necessarily competing over the same customers. You know, we're different businesses. You know, I think there was certainly obviously some concern, but we were pretty resilient, you know, and I think what happened after that was I think, a testament to what we had built and also the differentiation that we had created from Amazon and a lot of the other folks in the marketplace, is that we were okay.
How did Amazon first approach you to buy you?
That's something we probably can't discuss, right? The specifics of that?
Right.
Just the whole process, I mean, because...
What is so secretive about that? Like,
if we told you, then you'd know.
I mean, I think at the end of the day, it's a small world, actually, and there were introductions made, you know, from people who knew each other on our board and who were on their management team, and that was sort of the early discussions. And then I think lots of different things happened, I think, just to put it that way, in 2010.
Lots of different things. What do you mean?
Probably can't get into all the details of how that... the whole process, but
okay.
I think it's safe to say it was very unique circumstances that if we told you, you'd get it. So I think it's just one of those things that we don't know how to do it because it's very unique, it's confidential, and it's difficult to share.
Okay, I respect that.
It would be fun. It'd be fun to tell you this. It's a great story. It's a great story.
So we have some time left. Is there anything that I haven't asked that you think would be interesting to talk about? Any interesting anecdotes, such as how Amazon came to acquire you? What impact, if any, do your wives or the women in your life have on the business?
Well, Mark's sister, her name is Brooke, And Brooke is very, very famous with all the Quitsy employees because Brooke will tell us and Mark, and then Mark will tell everybody else, anytime, any product, anywhere on any of the websites is out of stock.
And any description that's wrong, and any picture that's wrong.
I mean,
and
Mark's sister, when Mark starts off with, I was talking to my sister, you know, something bad is next. So my wife, probably unpopular, actually, with the rest of our employees, because usually it's a constructive criticism about what we could be doing better, or I couldn't find this, or just some sort of, you know, gentle improvement that we can be making.
What's an example?
For example, it was my kid's birthday the other day, and he wanted a certain type of car. And, you know, our objective and our mission at Yo-Yo, which is our toy store, is to carry everything. And so I will say, you know, but we're not there yet. And so I'll say, hey, guys, you know, I just have to let you know that I'm one of the founders of this company, but I had to go to Amazon to buy, you know, my son's birthday gift. When I'll refer to this, I'll say, you know, my wife, you know, she's checking Amazon, you know, or some other site, you know, as opposed to Yo-Yo.
Vinny, I'm just curious, like your parents, are they immigrants?
Yes.
Where are your parents from?
So my parents are from India, from the northern part of India. They came
from Punjab?
They're actually, from the Punjab area. They were in what was previously Pakistan. So 1947, my dad and my mom actually emigrated to the Indian side, you know, during the riots, and then came over, went to London and then to the U.S. But with, you know, we talk a lot about risk and where our backgrounds and why we started this company. And interestingly enough, you know, my parents... sometimes, you know, think that we shouldn't take all these risks or shouldn't start these companies, but the risks that they took were way more challenging and way more substantial than what we did by quitting our jobs. My parents' story, as so many immigrant stories, is probably part of how I approach life and risk and why we decided to do what we do.
What role do your parents play in the company now, if any?
Well, my dad will definitely Google every, you know, he's Googling my brother, too. He Googles our company and likes to read all this stuff. But, you know, unlike our wives, he doesn't really give any advice about how to run it, but he likes to read about it all the time. I know that.
Your brother, did he start a company?
No. He's the U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York. And so, you know, he's in the press quite often as well. And so my dad always loves to read about him, too.
Well, thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Great. Excellent.
My guests have been Mark Lorre and Vinny Barrara, co-founders of Diapers.com. Coming up, we'll hear from Fred Swanaker, founder of African Leadership Academy, a school focused on training Africa's future leaders. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Fred Swanaker, founder of African Leadership Academy, an institution that's dedicated to developing Africa's next generation of leaders. The school admits students from across Africa and is committed to encouraging graduates to stay in Africa. Fred founded African Leadership Academy in 2004 when he was 27 years old. He's a graduate of McAllister College in Minnesota and has an MBA from Stanford Business School. Welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
You lived in over four countries before you were 18 years old. Why did your family keep moving?
You see, Ghana had an excess supply of skilled labor. And so other countries in Africa, as they were developing, would come to Ghana to look for professionals like lawyers and teachers and doctors. And my dad was a magistrate and my mother was a teacher. So they were recruited by different countries in Africa to come and work in their civil service. So that's how we moved around.
You did your primary and secondary schooling in Africa, and then you went to McAllister College in Minnesota. What was the thinking behind that?
My mother had been to graduate school in Minnesota. And so when I was growing up, I used to look at pictures in her album, and I would see pictures of her, you know, in the snow. McAllister is also known in Ghana and Africa because that's where Kofi Annan, the former Secretary General of the United Nations, went to college.
Did you have the intention of definitely returning, or was there part of you that thought, oh, you know what, maybe I'll stay put in the United States?
No, you see, one thing that all these experiences of living and working in different parts of Africa did is it made me very passionate about being an African. Mm-hmm. So most people who grew up in Africa only know the country that they were born in. In fact, their perceptions of the rest of the continent is what they see on CNN. I'd seen that there was tremendous beauty in Africa and tremendous potential, that we were really the next frontier of development.
What did you think were the key ingredients to helping with Africa's development?
when I look at the history of Africa, we've been through different phases of development. You had the period in the 60s, which was the independence era. You know, African countries breaking away from the shackles of colonialism and gaining their political independence. And then you moved into phase two, which was the period of real political instability. Then phase three, which is more stability. And there's more semblance of democracy. And when, you know, a change of government happens by force, it's seen as an exception now rather than the rule it was 20 years ago. The thing that's left to be done in Africa now, I believe, and this was my perception when I was graduating from McAllister College, was to create prosperity and to eradicate poverty. So the first job I got out of college was with McKinsey, mm-hmm. the consulting firm. Mm-hmm. I wanted to understand business. I wanted to see how business was being done in Africa. And that was how I began my journey of understanding, you know, what we needed to do to bring this next phase of change to Africa.
There have only been like a handful of leaders that have helped to transform African society, ranging from, you know, Nelson Mandela to Desmond Tutu. Why do you think Africa has kind of such a scarcity of leadership?
See, when Ghana got independence in 1957, there were something like 18,000 university graduates of the whole of sub-Saharan Africa, if you exclude South Africa from the picture. Countries like the DRC, the Democratic Republic of Congo, had four university graduates in 1957. So imagine the independence era arriving in Africa in the late 50s and early 60s. When Kenneth Kaunda was forming his cabinet in Zambia, you know, he had four university graduates to work with. And so that's the state at which Africans found themselves in the first set of leaders who took over the continent.
Your mother started a school in Botswana, and you, at age 18, became the headmaster of that school. Why did you become the headmaster of the school?
My mother had, was a really great teacher. And so the parents approached her and said, you know, would she set up a school for them? But she had no experience raising money. My dad had just passed away.
He died of high blood pressure and hypertension. Basically had a heart attack, yeah.
So she didn't have any financial resource of her own, and she had to look after four kids. So she said, look, I can't quit my job as a teacher and start the school for you. What I will do is I'll start a study group. And then it grew, more and more kids came, and then the next thing was 20 kids and then 25 kids. And then I had finished high school, and I had a year to wait before I went to college. And so my mother said, you know, why don't you run the school for me? And so for a year, I was the headmaster. I taught some classes. I managed some of the teachers and dealt with the parents. And in the afternoons, I'd go and meet with her, and we'd discuss the strategy for the next day. And today, that school is one of the top-performing primary schools in Botswana.
And it's called Mount Pleasant English Medium School.
Exactly, and it has about 300 children.
Did you think, you know, during that year that, you know what, I'd like to make a career out of being the headmaster of a school?
Absolutely not. I had no idea that one day I'd be back in education and in leadership development. You know, I saw my future as a businessman.
So here you were. You were at McKinsey, and then you decided to go to Stanford Business School. And McKinsey paid for your education at Stanford Business School, about $125,000. And you were supposed to return to McKinsey, but instead you decided to start African Leadership Academy. What was the catalyst for saying, you know what, there is a scarcity of leaders in Africa, I'm going to start ALA rather than return to McKinsey?
So in between my first and second year at Stanford, as most MBA students do, I had to find an internship. Given that I was supposed to go back to McKinsey after my MBA was finished, I thought, let me just do something interesting. So there was an opportunity to go and work in Nigeria to help set up a microfinance institution. Mm-hmm. And I went to Nigeria, and in the course of that, I met these wealthy families who were complaining to me about the fees they were paying to send their, you know, children to expensive boarding schools in the UK. They were paying about $50,000 a year to send them there. So I was thinking, wow, why are we paying so much money to send young people to these schools in the UK? Why don't we have the best education institutions in Africa that can keep them on the continent? Because I was worried that these young people that were leaving were the future leaders of Africa. So that's when the light bulb went off, and I said, you know, why don't I actually build this institution? And so I said, you know what, I need to find a way to pay this $120,000 off to McKinsey and really do this. I didn't know where I was going to get the $120,000 from, but when I graduated,
I called McKinsey and said, you know, I'm not coming back.
How did you raise the $120,000 to pay them back?
I had borrowed some money from my mom. And then also I had raised some money to start ALA from my friends and family, and part of that was the salary I was going to pay myself. And so what I did is I took the salary that I was going to pay myself and gave it to McKinsey.
Mm-hmm. So,
and so then I had no salary to live on for the next 2 years.
And where were you living at the time?
In Johannesburg.
So what was it like having no salary? What did that mean daily?
It meant daily I didn't know where my meals were going to come from, where I would get money to buy clothes from, and, you know, other basic things that people who have a salary take for granted. So I had to become creative in terms of the way I lived. My friends would buy me lunch, you know, so I made sure that I always had a lunch appointment with a friend.
Uh-huh. Where did you live?
I slept on people's couches and, you know, friends' cottages in the backyards, mm-hmm. and those kinds of things.
Your mother, as we discussed, was an educator. What was her perspective?
She thought I was crazy, even though she had done it herself. She hadn't done it, I guess, in such a risky manner.
Her name's Edna, and she eventually gave you $100,000, which, by the way, have you given back to her, or was it more of a gift?
Well, it's something I was meant to pay back, but I think over time she's forgiven the loan.
Ah, it's a forgivable loan.
Exactly.
I see. So here you are sleeping on friends' couches and having people buy you lunch. Was there one or two people in the early days that really helped to, you know, get the academy off the ground or to make the idea of the academy more of a reality?
Yes, definitely. I mean, they were my partners, my co-founders. You know, one was a man called Chris Bradford, who I had met when I was at business school, and then my two former bosses from McKinsey. Mm-hmm. We initially raised about $200,000.
And then you were looking to raise $7 million, and the bulk of that came from a woman named Rebecca Capizio. Why was Rebecca interested in African Leadership Academy?
We set out on a search for a possible campus. And we went to this area just outside of Johannesburg called the Cradle of Humankind, which is where some of the oldest human remains have been found. It's a very beautiful setting. And there was a conference center there that we approached and said, you know, can we rent this conference center and use it for our academy? And they said, you know, sorry, we're fully utilized, but why don't you go next door? There's a property there. There was a manager at the farmhouse, and we kind of shared what we were trying to do. And he said, you know, we don't have a space there that's big enough for you to use for your campus, but the owner of this property is very interested in education. Hmm. So why don't you send us something and we'll send it to the manager, to the owner. And we didn't know that the owner was this woman, Rebecca Capizio, who comes from the Oppenheimer family that owns De Beers in South Africa.
De Beers, the Diamond Empire.
The Diamond Empire, exactly. So we sent her a one-page description of what we were trying to do, and she wrote back and said, you know what, I don't have a facility that you can use, but I like this idea so much that I'm willing to build it for you.
Huh.
And we thought, wow, does she really know who we are? I mean, she likes, I mean, just from a paragraph, she's willing to commit. Does she know how much money we would need? So then we said, you know, okay, we're coming to Seattle in a few weeks. Can we come and meet with you?
Because she was living in Seattle at the time.
Exactly. That's why she wasn't at her property when we visited. Mm-hmm. And so we went and met with her, and you know, we said, look, this is going to cost us about $5 million to build it. Are you willing to commit this money? And she said, yeah. And that changed everything.
Do you remember that specific moment? Were you in her house when she talked to you about it?
We're sitting in a lobby in a hotel in Seattle, and she had come with her husband, and I was there with Chris. When we met her, it was kind of a surreal experience. You know, we were these 27-year-old guys with just an idea on a piece of paper.
Incidentally, in addition to Rebecca Capizio, another woman was pretty instrumental to you in the early days, and that was the former CEO of Hewlett-Packard, Carly Fiorina, mm-hmm. who had gone to high school randomly in Ghana. Mm-hmm. How did she help you?
At this time, I didn't know how to raise money. I had been to visit the dean at the Stanford Business School to ask him for advice on how to raise money. And one of his pieces of advice to me was that you should never ask for money in your first meeting with someone. So this is our first meeting with Carly Fiorina. And, you know, we had lunch with her, and then at the end she said, okay, so why did you want to meet with me today?
Mm. And meanwhile, you have his advice in your ear.
I had his advice in my ear. I said, don't ask her for money. So I said, well, you know, perhaps you could help us
with your relationships in the technology world to help us get some computers for our school. And he said, okay, fine, I'm happy to do that. And then she said, and I said, well, you know, maybe you could also help us build relationships with the South African government. And she said, yeah, sure, I'm happy to do that. And then she said, is there anything else? And so at this point, I'm sitting there thinking, okay, she, you know, she's asking us if we need money. But the dean of Stanford said, don't ask for money on your first meeting. So Chris is kicking me under the table saying, you know. So then eventually I was like, well, we're also looking to raise money and, you know, perhaps you could contribute. 3 months later, she gave us $100,000.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Fred Swanaker, founder of African Leadership Academy, a school focused on training Africa's future leaders. How did you encourage applicants? How did you encourage people to come?
We had, you know, surveyed parents. We had talked to headmasters of other schools in Africa, had asked them about the concept that we were proposing, and, you know, the feedback was generally quite positive. But we had never actually spoken to young people. And if you think about it, they were sort of the client base, the customers, in a way. So 2007, we said, oh, actually, no, we're opening our doors a year from now. We need to start recruiting our first class. So we hired a team of people, and we went around and started visiting schools. And we did a mailing to about 2,000 schools. And we were shocked when the deadline arrived and we had received 1,700 applications from 35 countries for our first class. And there were only 100 places available.
Who were some students who really impressed you? You're like, wow, I want this student in my school.
One of the things we asked in the application form, we said, tell us about a time you identified a need in your community, mm-hmm. and what did you do about it? And so Belinda's application, she talked about how she was she lived in a suburb of Harare in Zimbabwe. And every day she used to see these three kids coming around and begging for food. And so she approached them and to find out why they were begging, and it turned out that their parents had died from AIDS. And so she decided that she wanted to do something about this to help them so they could stop begging. And she had been learning agriculture at school and was learning how to raise chickens. So she asked her mom for, you know, about a couple of dollars and used that to buy a couple of chickens that could lay eggs. And she built this chicken business. And with that, she was able to generate enough income that she was able to feed this family of three, these three kids. And then she taught the kids how to look after the chickens and also how to grow a vegetable farm and so on. And soon they were able to look after themselves completely independently, and they were able to have enough funding that the oldest child could now go to school. And she did all this by herself when she was 16, 17.
You created from the start a financial incentive for your graduates to stay put in Africa. How does that work?
The vast majority of the young people that we admit to the academy cannot afford to pay the fees. So we give them scholarships. It costs about $25,000 per child for 1 year. We don't give them that scholarship as a grant, but as a forgivable loan. And so when they graduate from the two-year program and go into college, that loan continues accruing interest. So all we ask is that they return to Africa by the age of 25 and stay and serve the continent for 10 years. They can do whatever they want to do in Africa. And if they don't return, or if they leave at some point before they're 10 years old, then they have to repay that loan with interest. Mm-hmm. There's a model like this in Singapore and in Thailand. There's a school called Raffles Junior College, and they have a 97% return rate.
African Leadership Academy aims to develop the next generation of leaders. What does that mean practically or daily?
A big part of this development is what we call giving them practice in leadership. So while they're at the academy, they all have to do what's called a culminating project, where they either have to launch a business or launch a social venture in the community. And what we're trying to do there is to simulate the kind of experience that Mark Zuckerberg had in his dorm room at Harvard when he started Facebook. So over the last few years, we've launched about 42 different ventures, ranging from a bank that operates on our campus to a farm on the campus to a clothing store to sustainable community agricultural projects that have all been spearheaded by these young people. And we have a venture fund on our campus that invests in them. And our aim there is to really give them the taste of being an entrepreneur and being a leader in real time and real life. And we believe that if you give them this defining experience at that age,
it gives them the foundation and the passion to go on and do entrepreneurial ventures and to be leaders on a much bigger scale later on in their lives. If I hadn't had this experience when I was 18 running my mother's school, I don't think I would have had the confidence or the experience to one day do what I'm doing today with ALA, which is on a much bigger scale. And if you look back, a lot of entrepreneurs, Richard Branson, when he was 15, 16, was selling magazines. And that prepared him to go and launch Virgin one day. And so it's the same kind of practice and leadership that we like, that we spend a lot of time trying to give these young leaders. And then the other thing we're doing is exposing them to a network of mentors and potential advisors and people who can open doors for them as they go through different stages of their lives.
So what's an example?
There's a young man from the Democratic Republic of Congo. He's a refugee. He came to ALA on a scholarship, and while he was there, we had a guest speaker who visited campus. And this woman is involved in using theater as a way to help victims of trauma. Joseph was so struck by her talk that he said, you know, I really want to go and replicate this in my refugee camp. And in the process, the woman also got so involved that she helped him raise $20,000, and he used that to build the first high school in his refugee camp. And that's all happened because of that network that was struck, that conversation that happened when this woman visited campus to be a speaker.
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
My guest has been Fred Swanaker, founder of African Leadership Academy. If you'd like to learn more about the show, please visit our website at FromScratchRadio.com or follow us on Twitter at Jess G. Harris or find us on Facebook. Our website is FromScratchRadio.org. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch.